This is Radio Fax, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime. If you'd like a copy of the specially printed QSL card and a six-page information sheet by return of post, please send 50 pence in British stamps or three international reply coupons to Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG.
I used to wake up in the morning, I used to feel so bad. I got so sick of having sleepless nights, I went and told my dad. He said, son, now here's some little something, and stuck them on my wall. And now my nights seem quite so lonely, in fact, I don't know bad at all. Pictures of Lily, Lily, oh Lily.
Cinema Sound. David Watts of Dolby Laboratories explains all to Richard Buskin in Sound magazine. When Pink Floyd's film The Wall was screened in major movie theatres in 1982, it marked a new high point in the annals of cinema sound. It clearly indicated just how far methods had progressed and just how long it had taken to do so, since actors, singers and noisemakers were placed behind the screen in order to simulate dialogue, music and sound effects at the beginning of the century. Very early in the sound era, when 20th century Fox's Movietone sound-on-film system superseded the Vitaphone sound-on-disc process, the major Hollywood studios agreed to utilise a standardised amplification system. This quite simply consisted of the lowest common denominator at the time, amplifiers boasting an Academy filter, whose sole purpose was to stifle the high frequencies. Improved loudspeakers meant excessive brightness of sound, thus the necessity for removing the high frequencies in the cinema. The studios, meanwhile, were listening through the same filter. So when they mixed this movie soundtrack, they wound as much top as possible into the track. An empirical process evolved of pre-emphasis by the studios and de-emphasis by the cinemas, with mid-frequencies being boosted in order to give the false impression that there were highs in the cinema. Incredibly, or maybe not, considering the astuteness displayed by film industries over the past half century, This academy curve survived until about 15 years ago. Dolby Laboratories initially poked their noses into the film market with the intention of introducing their unique process of noise reduction. The company soon learned, however, that there was not much point in adding noise reduction to the unbalanced system that existed. It didn't really have a noise problem, remarked David Watts, applications manager at the Dolby plant in southwest London. But what it did have was either a bad distortion problem, because of all the pre-emphasis that had been put in the mixers, or a bad bandwidth problem, because the bottom had to be rolled off to balance the top being rolled off, leaving everything really MIDI. If you then decided to take out all of the filters within the whole industry and try to go for a sort of flat response, equalising loudspeakers to get things essentially flat and building special preamplifiers that can get a flat response from film up to the physical limits of the phonographic process and the projectors that exist, you could get the sound flat up to between 12.5 and 15 kHz. It would then, however, become incredibly noisy, because you'd open the window through which all the rubbish could fly in. That's where the noise reduction helps. So we were using the noise reduction system, in that respect, to rebalance the system. What was needed, therefore, was more quality. At that time, the alternative to optical tracks was magnetic film. The picture would first be developed, followed by a rough process of painting magnesium oxide strips down the side, and recording would then take place. The coating of oxides was erratic, and so every reel differed slightly in terms of the bias required. This, in turn, proved to be very expensive, about 10 times as much for a magnetic print as for an optical print. So, although there were films released in a variety of stereo sound systems, there were very few prints made of each. The net result of this was that cinema owners who had invested in the new equipment felt as if they had largely spent money for nothing, and those who had shown more prudence did not wish to follow suit and be caught out in the same way. Thus, up to that point, stereo had a very checkered career in the cinema. Eastman Kodak and RCA, meanwhile, had both been looking at ways in which stereo could be merged with 16mm optical film, and their research provided the opening for Dolby. Their initial system, however, was not a great success. RCA had built a recorder, and Kodak were doing some work on it, explains Watts. And they discovered that if you make it more hi-fi, and you split the track so that you get half the area, you get a noise problem. They then came to talk to us, and we sort of took over that work as Dolby Stereo, and that was a two-channel stereo medium. Everything else in the cinema up to that point was four-channel, and we thought that maybe two-channel would be okay, and very quickly found out that it wasn't. Two-channel stereo relies on somebody sitting in between two speakers and being in the middle to get a good centre image. Now that doesn't worry most people at home these days, but as soon as you put a picture with it, you get a conflict between what you see and what you hear. Anyone sitting off-centre in a cinema, which has just two loudspeakers, hears the dialogue from the closest speaker and sees it on the middle of the screen, and it slowly becomes disconcerting. That sound is coming from the wrong place. Traditionally, all cinema sound systems have always had at least three loudspeakers behind the screen, with a centre channel, and that enables you to make the sound of anything that is in the centre of the screen come out of that area, and everybody in the theatre hears it that way. Having realised that four channels were in fact necessary, Dolby found the cinema situation fairly favourable in this respect. Many theatres, notably large ones such as the Odeon and the Empire at Leicester Square, already had magnetic four-channel setups in a reasonably controlled environment. The existing layout of cinema speakers meant that it was not possible to simply apply domestic quadraphonic technology to the new environment. Watts outlines the considerations and Dolby's solutions. You have to choose the conditions that are most likely to occur and say, well, this is important and that isn't. And it was very important for us that if you wanted the dialogue to go to the centre, then it went to the centre. So we sort of turned these matrix systems around. Instead of having left, right, front, left, right, back, we made it so that we had left, centre, right across the front, and a single surround channel going all the way around the back of the theatre. That now relaxes some of the limitations. Because you've got three of the channels all at the front and reasonably close together, meaning that you don't get a huge separation between left and centre and right, you can then concentrate on getting better separation between the three at the front and the one at the back. Another thing is that whereas people sit equidistant from all four loudspeakers with a domestic quad system, in cinemas the screen is much more important, and so you don't place as much emphasis on the rear loudspeakers, although people can sit very close to them. So we came up with a way of using time delays to enhance the separation between front and back. The place you hear it first is where your brain thinks it comes from, even though it's actually coming from much louder from somewhere else. We always ensure that the screen arrives first, so even if you hear crosstalk from the surround loudspeakers, which can vary from 3 to 40 feet away, depending on the cinema, you still hear it coming from the direction of the screen. It also gives the additional benefit of being able to adjust for theatre size. The dubbing theatre is adjusted so that the mixer always hears it about 20 to 25 milliseconds after the screen. And from a small 50-seater to an enormous cinema, the audience gets the same effect. One complaint studios used to make about domestic quad was that the processed product sounded little like the original mix. To overcome the problem of disparate encoding, Dolby installed their own 424 encoder-decoder systems to mix through in the film studios. The original four tracks being recorded on the film are never heard. They also employed third octave equalizers to counter the difference in frequency response between movie theatres and dubbing theatres.
Oh,
Now the movie folk became more demanding. Having heard the very good sound in the studios, the quality was noticeably inferior in the cinemas, as these were not equipped with the same quality of power amplifiers and loudspeakers. The differences they were hearing now, however, were much smaller than the original ones, where they never expected it to sound anything like the original. It was at this point that the whole cinema sound scene took off. 10 years ago, major West End theatres had amplifiers that gave out 30 watts per channel. The Empire in Leicester Square will shortly be taking delivery of a system that boasts 18 kilowatts. Because of the acoustics in some places, it won't sound wonderful, no matter what you do. You can always improve things, however, by putting in better loudspeakers, and the current generation of cinema speakers have much better controlled spatial distribution. The present range of JBL speaker systems with direct radiator low-frequency sections provide an extremely flat response to the lowest usable octave. This, in turn, means that compared to the traditional horn-loaded low-frequency designs, they need very little equalisation. The most popular of these among the larger theatres is the 600-watt JBL 4675, which has a low-frequency enclosure housing twin 15-inch loudspeakers, an externally mounted constant coverage horn, and a compression driver boasting a frequency range of 35 Hz to 20 kHz. Dolby's latest sound processor, the CP200, is capable of controlling up to four projectors with a variety of formats, including 35mm Dolby Stereo Optical, 70mm Dolby Stereo, 6-track Magnetic, and 70mm Dolby Stereo Magnetic with Stereo Surround. We've probably now got to the point where in the very best cinemas, such as the Empire and the main screen at the Multiplex in High Wycombe, you're now running into the limitations of the optical track itself, says Watts. The next step on is to use Dolby SR to improve the performance of the track to the level where it's going to be indistinguishable from something like CD. You can probably measure the differences, but when you're dealing with a real cinema, it doesn't make any sense to go into something which is off film when you can keep it on film. The history of sound systems off film has been extremely checkered, what with synchronisation problems and the soundtrack from one movie turning up with the print of another. There again, the actual design of the theatres is another matter altogether. Many cinemas were never built for reproduced sound, so they have a much longer reverberation time than you want for replaying something. The Empire was designed specifically as a cinema. It's a nice, simple shape, and its acoustics are therefore among the very best. But it still has a few problems. It's got terrible slap echo from the back wall. But with current loudspeakers, you can control the dispersion such that you try not to hit the back wall. It's pretty good that way, but you can certainly hear it when it's empty, and you walk up the steps to the projection box. You turn around because you think someone's following you. That was David Watts there of Dolby Laboratories, describing developments in cinema sound. And now, Eddie Caffrey with a million-selling single.
Barry Ryan, Eloise. On the single it says, Barry Ryan and the Majority. Released on the MGM record label in the UK in 1968. Its original catalogue number, MGM1442, backed with Love, I Almost Found You on the B-side. Barry Ryan's disc of Eloise was a song written by his twin brother Paul. It achieved number 2 on the 23rd of November 1968 in the British charts. It went to number 1 in Holland, Italy, Australia, Austria, Belgium, Switzerland and Germany, with prominent chart positions in most other European countries and abroad. In America, it reached the number 50 spot for 1 week. Eloise was released in Britain in October 1968 and by January 1969 had sold 1 million copies worldwide, totaling over 3 million by April 1969. Paul and Barry Ryan, real name Safferson, are the twin sons of well-known British singer Marion Ryan, and were born on the 24th of October 1948 in Leeds, England. It took the twins 3 years to persuade their famous mother to let them make a record. Their first disc was Don't Bring Me Your Heartaches, released in October 1965, and was a success. They then made a nationwide tour, TV and radio appearances, plus continental TV and radio performances. They continued recording for Decca until 1968, when they were assigned to MGM, who also signed them to a £100,000 film contract. Eloise was the first disc for MGM, with Barry, who had turned solo performer, while Brother Paul having decided to concentrate on writing. And he wrote this great song, Eloise, Barry Ryan.
She goes. I find it hard to realize that love was in her eyes. It's dying now. She knows I'm crying now. Sun that makes the day, that lights the way. And when that star goes by, I'll hold it in my hands and cry, her love is mine, my sun will shine.
Broadcasting to the people who really listen to shortwave, this is Radio Facts, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime.
Europe in danger of losing hold on new chip boom. A report by Mary Fagan, technology correspondent of The Independent. Europe is poised for a new boom in the electronics sector with the advent of satellite and microwave television and the need for special chips made from gallium arsenide rather than the familiar silicon. However, the big potential market for these devices is already threatened by America and Japan. According to Mike Peters of Plessy, the United Kingdom's only manufacturer of gallium arsenide transistors, the devices which sold for £25 in the defence market a year ago now sell for only £2 to manufacturers of reception equipment for satellite television because of undercutting by the US and Japanese suppliers. He warns that if Europe doesn't make it in the consumer market for these devices, called gallium arsenide, field effective transistors, or FETs, they will be squeezed out. This could have implications for national security, because gallium arsenide technology underpins many defence applications. Gallium arsenide has always been regarded as a niche technology, selling low volumes at considerable margins to defence contractors. According to Mr. Peters, however, having survived in the defence market and developed the basic technology, we now have a sudden consumer boom. People are coming to us for millions and millions of transistors, but the competition from the Japanese and Americans is fierce. If we do not pitch in now, the UK microwave capability will be wiped out. Plessy, which makes the chips at Towcester, is increasing annual capacity from around 500,000 to more than 10 million FETs. It's also making more advanced devices, gallium arsenide integrated circuits, which will eventually replace the FETs. Mr. Peters warns that margins are becoming tight. Gross margins are already down to 30% in an industry where the average is 70%, he said. The undercutting in the United Kingdom is such that Plessy is selling the same transistors in the United States for 20% more than at home. GEC decided last year to not push forward in developing volume production of gallium arsenide devices, although it still has research capabilities. Plessy's main competition comes from Advantech of the US and NEC of Japan. Everyone is a bit frightened at the way things are developing. The huge consumer demand could affect the traditional military market, and the Americans are making all the running right now, Mr. Peters said. That report from Mary Fagan, the technology correspondent of The Independent.
Following Douglas Self's article in a recent issue of the Electronics and Wireless World magazine regarding subjectivism in audio, the letters pages have been raging. Continuation of this correspondence includes a further letter from Reg Williamson.
Predictably, Doug Self's article has provoked correspondence on this thorny topic. Great though my respect for John Lindsay Hood is, I regret his letter in the September issue because he has unwittingly thrown crumbs of succour to the subjectivist sparrows. They will peck eagerly at what he said, as further evidence that the engineers don't always know what they are doing. John's generous even-handedness is wholly admirable, but a tactical error nevertheless. Let me try and put it all in perspective. As I write, I have just dug out of my archives an article I was commissioned to write for Wireless World and published in June 1969. It analysed the state of audio amplifier design at that time and covered comprehensively, so I thought, the matter of crossover distortion. It included a cover picture in colour showing this objectionable artifact. It was also my impression that everyone by then was familiar with the concept that any amplifier design using NFB had to preserve the essential characteristics of such feedback under both static as well as dynamic conditions. Moreover, there were plenty of test techniques to ensure that obtained. It was my view at the time that most of the important problems of transistor audio amplifier design had been solved. In any case, what hiccups did occur arose during the earlier transition into the semiconductor age. A new, younger generation of design engineers had emerged and were, 'tis true, fully au fait with the technology. but many were totally unfamiliar with the requirements of high-quality audio amplifier design. Some had never heard of crossover distortion. This, sir, was almost two decades ago. With our disciplined engineers approached, we ran the risk of missing the real differences between us and the subjectivist trendies, because we can furnish all the objective data we like, and they still won't believe us. Why? Simple. Because one of their tenets of faith is that there are phenomena we don't understand and won't ever. Another tenet is that for real engineers, real engineers will regard as fatally flawed, that the human ear must always be the final arbiter of whether the sound is acceptable or not. Note, I did not say faithful or otherwise, and for good reason. Emotional content enters into it in a way that I certainly have never understood. Perhaps a clinical psychologist can explain it. It's useless insisting that as a qualitative assessing instrument, the human ear or brain interface is insufficiently consistent, and as far as quantitative assessment goes, almost useless. Nevertheless, for purposes of argument, it may be regarded as a measuring instrument of sorts, so long as one observes the golden rule that I drum into my students. If two measurements don't agree, then one or even both are certainly wrong. Again, a concept the subjectivists will never understand, even if they wanted to. As I said in my earlier letter, which we can do nothing about, the ex-shop assistants, our target must be those who ought to know better, those who suggest, for example, that a minimum of NFV is a good thing, or even obliquely lend credence to all this cable and fancy capacitor rubbish. The latest lunacy is a passive preamplifier, a contradiction in terms if ever there was one, and a real con. There isn't one specialist hi-fi publication in this country that offers to its readers competent and reliable engineering expertise. Happily, this trend appears to be in reverse in the USA, and at least two respected magazines are now firmly rejecting the irrational myths that are so avidly promoted in the UK by the less responsible sections of the industry and its sycophantic press friends. Finally, in our attempts to eliminate this parasitic blight on the science and craft of audio, we need to preserve a sense of humour. And to this end, I must repeat my favourite true story. A well-known professional reviewer was lobbying a senior figure from a leading audio manufacturing company seeking to evaluate their latest product, an audio amplifier. The senior figure, who had a somewhat jaundiced view of the reviewing profession, eventually responded, tongue well in cheek, with, "Well, yes, you can, if you compare it with a piece of straight wire." Pause, and came the apprehensive answer, "What sort of wire?" Well, that was a letter written by Reg Williamson, which appeared in the Electronics and Wireless World in a recent issue.
And then a letter from Steve Price. Firstly, I would like to say how pleased I was to see Douglas Self's article. One feels impelled to say that such a breath of sanity is long overdue in the now crazy world of audio criticism. I do, however, take the point made by Reg Williamson that because this superlative article has appeared only in the pages of Electronics and Wireless World, Mr. Self is preaching largely to the converted. Notice that I use the term largely. For in the very same letters column, we are treated to the views of Mr. J.L. Lindsley Hood. And it appears that Mr. Lindsley Hood is far from being converted. I can only say, and I make this statement as an amateur electronics enthusiast, that I find the views expressed by JLH almost unbelievably naive. After reiterating the oldest chestnut in the subjectivist litany, that steady-state measurements do not tell us enough about an amplifier's dynamic performance, Mr. Lindsley Hood then invites us to contemplate the possibility that the humble capacitor may possess as yet unexplained manipulative properties when confronted with music signals. What I find so unacceptable about the above arguments is that they are propounded without any reference to the tests outlined by Mr. Self, which demonstrably prove that these effects do not in reality exist. I refer, of course, to the Baxandall cancellation technique and the Hafler straight wire differential test. Perhaps Mr. Linsleyhood would like to comment on this. That letter from Steve Price, Bethel, Carnarvon in Gwynedd.
And only the good die young. Whoa, 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 whoa. I tell you, only the good die young. Only the good die young. You got a nice white dress and a party on your confirmation. You got a brand new soul, and a cross of gold. But Virginia, they didn't give you quite saints. The sinners are much more fun. You know that only the good die young.
From the Daily Telegraph comes this article. The calm, clipped tones of the BBC accent, recognised by 25 million listeners to the World Service as the official voice of Britain, are to be faded out in favour of colloquial, friendly voices from today's Britain. Along with the BBC accent, which the corporation has decided is pompous and has dated, the sun will set on its musical equivalent, Imperial Echoes, the rousing brass band tune which has preceded Radio Newsreel for 48 years. American radio stations which relay the World Service have condemned the tune, composed by Arnold Saffroni Middleton, as strident and inappropriately imperialistic. Soon, a modernised version, played on a synthesiser, will replace it. The new image signals a change to the entire World Service in English. its most radical overhaul is designed to keep the service preeminent in international broadcasting, said Mr. John Tusa, managing director. The tone of the service was verging on the pompous, he said, though he admitted, quite a lot of people have written in about this official gazette style of voice, many of them approving of it. But Mr. Tusa added, there's a danger of falling into the Morris Minor syndrome, where people say, what a marvellous thing, what a wonderful product, and 20 years later, the company's gone bust. The revamp in which savings from other parts of the world service have been ploughed back into an extended output of financial news, politics, music, media, and youth programmes would reflect the new Britain, Mr. Tusa said. We're not going to be imprisoned in a vision of Britain which is not the Britain of the 1980s. We now compete with satellite and other broadcasters who can achieve better reception, and we cannot afford to stand still, be complacent, and assume our audience will automatically stay with us. Mr. Anthony Rendell, editor of the World Service in English, said that the changes in tone were initiated to attract younger listeners. We don't need that solemnity and official sound, he said. We do need younger people. But he went on to say that already the typical World Service listener was under 30, male, urban, well-educated and listening late at night. Mrs. Jocelyn Hay, chairman of the radio pressure group Voice of the Listener, was sceptical of the changes. She said that the pursuit of colloquial and idiomatic modern voices could mean sacrificing the clarity of diction and standard English for which the World Service was renowned. The World Service's use of standard English and correct pronunciation is one of the things that have made British broadcasting the best in the world, she said. It must never degenerate into the slang and slovenly speech found on other BBC networks. I have never heard anyone overseas call the World Service pompous. I suspect it is jealousy on the part of other broadcasters. As well as the updated version of Radio Newsreel, called simply Newsreel, more financial reporting and a comprehensive 60-minute world survey, NewsHour, have been introduced. But a few things will remain unchanged. Big Ben's chimes at the beginning of the news from London are untouched, and Lily Bolero, the World Service identity tune, originally a Protestant marching song, has escaped the synthesizer treatment. Mr. Tusa said, we simply could not move Lily Bolero. It is so strong and identifies the whole network. That's a report from the Daily Telegraph.
From Lineup, the journal of the Institute of Broadcast Sound. OK for level. When you're balancing a programme, who do you aim to satisfy? Yourself? The producer? The listener? Are the interests of the three coincident? What is quality in terms of radio sound balance? As close a representation as possible of real life, or a balance which takes account of the listener in less than ideal conditions? Philip Bilson describes some extensive rethinking at the BBC. The brief was to examine the way the BBC delivers its radio programmes to the listener from the widest possible perspective. Any evaluation had to take into account the likely realistic conditions of most listeners, and a new compromise sought, different for each network if necessary, which would satisfy both the specialist armchair listener and the vast majority who listened in noisy environments. Network controllers were invited to specify their target audience and the kind of sound required. Their answers assisted in formulating a balance philosophy for each network, which was to be the basis of the guidelines. FM was to be the primary consideration, as in the New Age Post-Broadcasting Act, that would be the only frequency band available for our present range of programmes. Above all, we had to ensure that BBC radio programmes were as audible as possible, particularly in the face of the competition from the plethora of new stations in the future. I had the privilege, in consultation with a wide range of colleagues in operations, presentation and production, of finding some answers and formulating them into new balance and control guidelines to be issued to all sound staff in BBC Radio. My aim was to codify as effectively as possible best current practice, and I believe we have succeeded in this. I was aware from the outset that there were potentially as many answers as there are sound operators within the corporation, ranging from opinions which represent complete satisfaction with the status quo to those who believe radical change to be long overdue. I was also aware that what at that time held no more than the status of my own opinions had themselves to be carefully examined, educated, and validated over the succeeding months. I was, of course, concerned to produce something simple enough to be workable in language which would mean exactly the same thing to everyone. Most difficult of all was the task of convincing people that this exercise was being conducted in the context of a very high personal admiration for BBC Radio sound balancers, nearly all of whom are more experienced than myself in their own specialised areas, and within the framework of widespread general admiration both outside and within the BBC. As far as I was concerned, there was nevertheless another side to the coin, namely the strongly held conviction amongst some radio people that wide dynamic range can be equated with quality. In other words, that radio and hi-fi sound are one and the same thing. This cannot be the case, as the hi-fi enthusiast is likely to be listening at high levels and therefore may like a fairly wide dynamic range. The radio listener, on the other hand, is likely to be listening at quite low levels, so consistency of audibility has to become part of the quality equation. The task was to achieve that consistency without sacrificing quality for the listener at high level. I began by taking a week off work, or at least a week out of Broadcasting House, listening to all networks in all kinds of environments and logging any problems on a dictating machine. I quite deliberately didn't sit down in the living room to listen, as I don't know anyone who does this regularly. Rather, I drove my wife to work, did the washing up, wrote letters, etc. Great care was taken to listen at normal levels, that is, loud enough to hear the programme comfortably above anything else I was doing, but not so loud as, say, to mask the sound of the phone ringing. Simultaneously, a BBC PPM chart recording was made at Broadcasting House of the relevant network. The results, together with some research into common listener complaints and input from production and presentation departments and from audience surveys, formed a starting point for investigation. Radio 1 had already formed its guidelines and associated Optimod settings, and the task ahead was similarly to dissect the other networks in consultation with a representative from each presentation department. I am particularly indebted to John Sparrow, Radio 2, Piers Burton Page, Radio 3, and John Breach, Radio 4. Their individual input, both as regards individual networks and the overall shaping of the guidelines, has been at least as significant as my own. I would also like to acknowledge the help of Graham Clifford from Engineering Section in London Control Room. His knowledge of transmission limiters and processes was invaluable. Similar methodologies were adopted for each network. First, demonstrate the problem. This was achieved by using a variety of recordings off transmission, transmission tapes, etc. All these came from a time window of roughly a week for each network, and on playback the number of demonstrable accident black spots within that period was a major factor in convincing people that there was a problem to be solved. There followed a period of experimentation, initially with off-air sample programmes or with programme rebalancers, followed in the case of radios 2 and 4 by experiments on air. For each network, a decision had to be taken for or against Optimod FM or similar processing. In the case of Radio 2, the Optimod already in circuit there has been retained with modified settings, but for varying reasons on radios 3 and 4, new pre-emphasis limiters, replacing the existing elderly equipment, which is much more severe in operation, were found to be preferable and acceptable to the transmitter engineers. From the outset, it was clear that most problems were common to all networks. The solutions, however, have varied. It quickly became obvious that the worst single problem, unexpected changes in level, particularly at junctions, was potentially the most intractable, and certainly one of the most long-standing. For example, as long ago as April 1932, The Wireless World complained in an editorial. It should not be necessary for the listener to have his finger continually on the volume control. After once he has adjusted it to his liking on, say, the first item broadcast. Suppose the first item is an orchestral piece received at a volume which is satisfactory for the average room. Then, as soon as that item is finished, on comes an announcer, and his voice comes through as if he were himself trying to reach his listeners direct without the medium of the ether. The voice is strong enough to be heard not only in the room, but some way down the road as well. Sometimes the control engineer appears to have sympathy for the listeners, and the volume is abruptly cut down after the announcer has got over the first few words. It surely must not be suggested that after all these years of experience the engineers have failed to effect a remedy for so outstanding a shortcoming in their part of broadcasting technique.
In the town where I was born, lived a man who sailed to sea. And he told us of his life in the land of submarines. So we sailed on to the sun till we found a sea of green. And we lived beneath the waves in our yellow submarine.
We all live in a yellow submarine.
In BBC Network Radio, there are always at least two sound people involved at programme junctions. The continuity operator, sitting with the network announcer, and the balancer of at least one programme coming live from a studio or time-shifted on tape. It's my experience that each naturally blames the other when things go wrong. The new guidelines reinforce the balancing role of continuity. Ultimate responsibility for programme junctions now rests at that point of final programme control. The extract from Wireless World applied to an AM network in, as far as I know, pre-processing days. Such problems crop up less frequently today on AM networks due to the relatively high levels of processing generally applied at distribution, primarily to aid reception in adverse conditions. Compression, which is an important part of that processing, tends to even things out. This is not true, however, of the FM networks, even on those to which light processing is applied, as with Radio 2. Mismatches here are clearly heard by the listener, sometimes resulting in several million potential volume control adjustments nationwide. The seriousness of this kind of problem is, however, often not apparent to professionals sitting in a controlled environment, listening at moderate, let alone high, sound levels. They can hear everything clearly, Broadcasting House's phantom drillers permitting, without environmental noise masking programme. On the other hand, a listener who sets the level comfortably above environmental interference is likely, under the present control regime, to encounter periods when programme falls into the noise floor. It is therefore in everyone's interest that listening levels in the cubicle should be kept as low as possible, within the constraints of production and technical requirements, to simulate the listening conditions of those at home. This alone is the clearest single factor differentiating the experience of the listener and that of the programme team, probably more significant than processing applied at distribution, for example. It's the change that has caused most concern amongst operators, many of whom are accustomed to listening at fairly high sound levels in order to hear technical faults, above, frequently, the constant production hubbub of the cubicle. Monitoring at lower levels will entail varying loudspeaker levels between known fixed points throughout the making of a programme, something which goes against the best instincts of many balancers. The fact that the loudspeaker dim key is already used frequently, certainly during recording sessions, suggests that this obstacle may be imagined rather than real. Variations in perceived level are, of course, not only a potential problem at programme junctions. There are similar happenings within programmes, sometimes deliberately, at times accidentally. Whatever the intention of the balancer and producer, such level changes can cause a problem for the listener, if the differences are too great. Differentiating between material where limited level changes are desirable, for example music and drama, and that where a fairly consistent presentation level represents the optimum state, for example information programmes, was an important step in formulating individually tailored network guidelines. Speech conveying information is rarely delivered consistently at the microphone, however, and level changes cannot always be accurately predicted, though one news balancer admirably demonstrated her abilities actively to over-control live speech on The World at One. So it is possible, and should certainly be cultivated. Small amounts of compression, i.e. low ratios at high thresholds, were found to be of great help in achieving consistency here. But why, if compression is such a good idea, has it not caught on already? The answer is quite simple. The BBC's current range of compressor limiters are inadequate in that they act rather aggressively, except in the limit mode, one factor being their lack of sophisticated automatic recovery networks. Some modern devices sound good even on speech with noisy backgrounds. Their automatic recovery networks allow quite high levels of compression to be used with little or no detrimental effect. There are several devices on the market. After subjective testing and evaluation, one has been chosen as a standard to supplement or replace existing units in studios. Music programmes similarly need better dynamic control available to the operator to catch unexpected high peaks, if average programme levels are to be increased. For this purpose, another commercial limiter designed for broadcast applications was chosen. This device will of course serve as an excellent speech limiter as well. In formulating the guidelines, we had to acknowledge that no balance and control instruction could actually teach a person to balance, as slavish adherence to prescribed PPM levels never guarantees a satisfactory result, as the PPM reflects only one parameter, electrical level, of a particular sound. It rapidly became clear that the current description of where a PPM peaks to was far too loose. Accordingly, I set about formulating something more precise, as follows. Peaking to N means frequent peaks at N, accepting the possibility of overshoots. This means that the PPM should actually reach or exceed the specified level almost every time it rises. This was fine for speech and also for music, with a naturally restricted dynamic range. However, with classical and similar balancers, it was clear that the PPM naturally reaches a specified level much less frequently. In order to develop a suitable instruction, I observed a music SM rebalancing a variety of records, and came to the conclusion that the traditional phraseology should be dispensed with in this situation in favour of an instruction that the PPM should reach or exceed a particular level with a certain degree of frequency. A primitive algorithm was therefore developed, the time constant chosen being 20 seconds. You'll be glad to know that, in blind tests, music balancers didn't object to the result. So, where do we go from here? Soon, all BBC Radio Sound staff will receive a two-colour Filofax year planner size copy of the new guidelines. They can, if they like the look of it, pin it up as a chart on their bedroom wall. Sooner or later, they should find some new dynamic devices in studios, and when their producer objects to this bit of gadgetry sitting prettily on top of the desk, they can tell him the story of one Andrew Parfitt, producer, who, while sitting in a traffic jam outside the Blackwall Tunnel, became exceedingly irritated by the wide dynamic range of an interview on Bookshelf. "Why can't I hear it without adjusting the volume knob?" he asked. For all our sakes, we need more producers who ask that question. Never mind the finesse, feel the audibility. Maybe too unsubtle a slogan. Both simultaneously are desirable and possible. The initiative is now where it should be, in the hands of the BBC's balancers.
She can kill with a smile, she can wound with her eyes, and she can ruin your faith with her casual lies. And she only reveals what she wants you to see. She hides like a child, but she's always a woman to me. She can lead you to love, she can take you or leave you. She can ask for the truth, but she'll never believe. And she'll take what you give her as long as it's free. Yeah, she steals like a thief, but she's always a woman to me. She can wait if she wants. She's ahead of her time. Oh, and she never gives out. And she never gives in. She just changes her mind. And she'll promise you more than the Garden of Eden. And she'll carelessly cut you and laugh while you're bleeding. But she'll bring out the best and the worst you can be. Blame it all on yourself, 'cause she's always a woman to me.
And now to the great debate, a two-hour television programme transmitted by Channel 4 following the publication of the White Paper on Broadcasting by the British government. Three decision-makers were to be questioned by a panel described here.
Each will be cross-examined, not so much by me, but by three other people with strong views on the future of television. They're John Mortimer, author, playwright and QC, whose distinguished career has spanned the Crown Film Unit in World War II, Rumpole of the Bailey and Paradise Postponed. He also wrote the TV screenplay for Brideshead Revisited. Philip Whitehead, leading independent producer and former Labour MP, who's worked on BBC's Panorama and ITV's This Week. He now makes programmes for Channel 4 and BBC 2. And Andrew Neil, editor of the Sunday Times, formerly of the Conservative Party Research Department, and The Economist magazine, who has experience of both presenting and reporting on British and American TV. In a moment, they and the studio audience will have a chance to put their questions to the decision makers here in the hot seat. Tim Renton, Home Office Minister, responsible for broadcasting. Millionaire publisher Robert Maxwell. And our first man in the hot seat tonight, Richard Dunn, chairman of the ITV Association. It's these ITV companies like Thames, Granada, Anglia and Grampian, all 15 of them, that'll be most affected by the government's plans. But first, let's remind ourselves how the ITV network fits into the British television picture.
Since this first BBC recording in 1936, British television has led the world, winning prizes for a system whose reason for being was public service broadcasting. At the heart of the system was the Reithian ideal, not only to entertain, but also to inform the viewing public. It was 20 years before independent television loosened the BBC's grip on the airwaves. Amidst fears that output funded by advertising would lower standards, 14 regional companies started transmitting between 1955 and 1962. Their programmes linked to make up the ITV network.
Later in the programme, Robert Maxwell had this to say about the Independent Broadcasting Authority.
The ITV companies, the IBA, was a disaster by and large in recent years, and there's no future for it, and I, for one, invite the British public to welcome its demise. Well, and it should be replaced by the new commission as soon as possible in order to end the uncertainty that is reigning at present in the system.
But I became a successful independent producer because I operated in a regulated system which insisted on a wide mix of broadcasting.
Regulation is the death of enterprise. If we want to become somebody in the world, we've got to end regulation. Let the people go free. Let the market decide.
Can you understand, Mr. Maxwell, why that worries people very greatly when they see you with your philosophy entering the field?
Well, my philosophy has provided almost 40,000 jobs. I'm very proud at the success of Maxwell Communication has all over the world. And from what I can see, entrepreneurs do more for Britain than politicians. And I'm proud to be an entrepreneur and not a politician.
Philip Whitehead, thank you.
And then, later on in the programme...
Welcome also to Timothy Renton, the Home Office Minister for Broadcasting. His department is directly responsible for the white paper we're discussing tonight. However, its contents have also been shaped by the views of the Prime Minister herself and the free enterprise philosophy of the Department of Trade and Industry under Lord Young.
There have been other reports on the future of broadcasting, other times when the British public were told everything was about to change. And like the others before it, the Peacock Report was expected to die. But the government, and particularly Mrs. Thatcher, were determined to see it through. Last summer, she told the country ITV is the last bastion of restrictive practices. This summer, battle was joined between two of her ministers, Douglas Hurd for the Home Office and Lord Young for the Department of Trade and Industry. The DTI are keen both to encourage new industry and to lower the cost of advertising. Like the advertisers, they take the line that it costs too much for these messages to reach our eyes.
And here...
The Home Office are keen to preserve standards and quality. The white paper is the result, a decisive move towards deregulation with only a slight touch of supervision. The new ITC will adopt a less heavy-handed and discretionary approach than its predecessor. So, to what extent will public service broadcasting continue? For the time being, the BBC is cocooned by its licence, but there is subscription on the horizon, and the government sees a time when the licence will disappear. Will the BBC be able to maintain standards without the guarantee of the licence fee, or will it slide into a ghetto of subscription television? As for Channel 4, it will have a public service remit. But not only will it be self-supporting, it will also be in direct competition with its old protector. So, to what extent will Channel 4 have to change its style to hold its own in a new overwhelmingly commercial environment? Is all this the beginning of a slippery slope leading to PAP programmes? Or have the government got it right?
The scene in the BBC boardroom when they saw the white paper.
Timothy Renton was then in the chair.
The buzzwords are freedom of choice. Now, what have you done to ask the viewers about what they want? Did they have a hand in writing the white paper? Have you got sackfuls of mail from them? Their views been incorporated in the white paper?
Well, I can assure you that I, for some months ago, thought I should take the door out of my office, the ordinary door, and install a revolving door instead. Because there have been so many people coming in, understandably, over the last 15
These
months.
These aren't viewers. These
no,
are the people
are
with
all,
interests.
They are the people
vested
whom
interests.
You've had, like Richard Dunn, with you tonight. There have been representatives, indeed, of the viewers' associations. Many, many people.
But how?
No, come on. How, nobody's saying not true. How, you only have to look at my visitors list.
How do you know that all?
No, wait a second. Wait a second. But I don't actually think the buzzword is actually choice, as you put it, or it's the mixture of choice and quality. I mean, it is an obvious problem that as the quantity increases, how do you keep up the quality? This is no new problem. It's always been the $64,000 question.
Well, if you
now, I think
if you
we
haven't
have
been
got
talking
the balance.
To the viewers.
I think we've got the balance about right in the white paper.
If you haven't been talking to the viewers and surveying what they really want, whether they want our present system turned upside down, many people feel that you've been taking your orders from the advertisers.
No, I didn't say I had me talking to viewers. I said, but I don't know whether you were listening at the end of such a long programme, that a great many people have been into my office over the last 18 months representing consumers, viewers, advertisers, the television companies, the cable companies, the lot. Because everyone's been known that we were writing this white paper. It's been no secret. It's taken a long time. And what it is, it's a distillation of ideas, of suggestions, with the aim of keeping the quality there as the choice multiplies. That's not easy. And one thing that's worth stressing, because I don't think either the previous, your previous interviewees, your previous candidates in the hot seat said it, no one has to buy a dish. None of these satellite channels are going to come into your living room unless you actually make the positive choice to go out and get the dish. So if you don't do that, right, you're going to have the money to do it too. All that we are doing, in fact, from a government point of view, is saying there'll be one more terrestrial channel available. There'll be number 5 of the terrestrial channels. But of course, an awful lot of people in this country have, as Mr. Maxwell said, decided of their own choice to buy video cassette recorders over the last few years, which implies that they did not find the choice of 4 channels good enough. That's one reason why they went to get VCR.
Timothy Renton there of the Home Office, saying that he is interested in what viewers, and presumably listeners, have to say to him. And we've got our copy of the Broadcasting White Paper here. It's a document of 45 pages, of which only 2 have any mention about the radio situation. Needless to say, there is no coverage of HF on those 2 pages. Anyway, we'll read the white paper to you in another programme. And now to something we recorded from HCJB from Ecuador on 6205, strangely, about clandestine stations.
I would say probably we're seeing a slight increase, at least, maybe a major increase in clandestines. Pirates, on the other hand, are a different story. You can trace the pirate level pretty closely. It correlates very positively with the sunspot cycle. And the pirate operation, again, there are a few exceptions to this, but most pirate stations have to operate with very low watt powers, and they have to rely on good propagation to be heard. And when the sunspot cycle gets low, the number of pirates gets low. Now that we've passed the low point and the number of sunspots should increase, I suspect we'll see an increase in pirate stations. Of course, the eagerness of the authorities to clamp down on pirates also has something to do with it. But the good pirate operator who keeps his station on the air only briefly and not on a regular schedule probably can avoid the authorities unless he gets going in some directions that really upset them and they make a major effort. So I think the sunspots have a lot to do with that. Numbers activity remains at a fairly substantial level. There tends to be an ebb and flow in this as well, but even the casual listener doesn't have much trouble running across a number station. I know people who have listened to shortwave broadcasts for years and years and never heard a pirate, and others who have never heard a clandestine except some of the easier ones to hear, like Radio Caiman. But even somebody who may be turning on a shortwave set for the first or second time may stumble across a number station, and that lets you know there are quite a few of them out there.
Clandestine stations, you say, are political stations. They're focused mostly, are they not, in Latin America, the Middle East, and Africa?
Yes, I would agree with that. Remember that the clandestine broadcaster ultimately hopes to come to power, at least the organization behind him. And this is why you see so many clandestine operations in Central America, for example, where we have a number of the contra stations, all of whom I think now are using some variation on the name Radio Liberacion. You have to excuse my bad Spanish. And of course you have the stations that oppose the government of El Salvador, particularly something like Radio Venzo Ramos, although there have been others as well. In the Middle East, you have a number of stations that are opposed to Khomeini. There are probably more anti-Iranian clans right now than any other group. You have some stations in Lebanon that some people might say are not pure clandestines, but they aren't licensed by the Lebanese government. Of course, one would say that's not surprising, since what does the Lebanese government control? Almost by definition, anything operating in Lebanon these days is a clandestine. It's interesting that one Middle East station, which I will not name, is even in a rather interesting position, that it receives funding from both Israeli and Muslim sources, and that's kind of a unique situation. So it's in these trouble spot areas that you will find the clandestines operating. In Africa, you have stations that oppose the Marxist government of Angola, particularly the Voice of the Black Cockerel that UNITA operates. You have in South Africa, operating from South Africa, Radio Truth, which opposes the government of Zimbabwe. And while undoubtedly funded, supported heavily by South Africa, may have some anti-Zimbabwe government elements also connected with it. So the hotspots produce the clandestines, yes.
Are they in the normal broadcast bands, or do you have to go searching elsewhere to find many of the clandestine stations?
Unlike pirates, who often do form sort of unofficial bands, a clandestine can pop up almost any place. One tactic that some of the anti-Khomeini clans have used, at least in the past, is even to hover near a government frequency, hoping that you will stumble across it when you're looking for the government station. And we get some of these semi-clans that do this. For example, Radio Impacto, which the Sandinistas claim is funded by the CIA, is now operating on 5030, right next to Cuba's Radio Rebelde. And I'm sure that selection of frequency is deliberate.
And then an air check for Radio Atlantico del Sur.
Radio Atlántico del Sur.
That was the British station which operated during the Falklands War from Ascension Island, transmitting in Spanish, beamed towards the islands. And there was some involvement in organising that station by somebody called Neil French Blake, who was once programme controller for Thames Valley 210, the independent local radio station in Reading, England. All that from HCJB, who then go off the air at 0830, leaving our signal on the channel, which is why our switch time from 1611 is 0830, while HCJB is on its winter schedule.
The time in Quito, 3:30 a.m., the same as 0830 hours UTC.
Murdoch, Maxwell, Smith, and the others intended to launch a single package.
If you get used to listening to AM signals through a synchronous detector, you will find it quite painful if you have to go back to an envelope detector. The improvement in signal-to-noise ratio and reduction in chatter from adjacent stations is particularly helpful on weak or fading signals. We produce a complete boxed phase lock synchronous detector, which accepts 455 kHz IF input to suit many receivers. The two audio line level outputs can be fed into a hi-fi stereo system, and the four front panel controls allow reception of double sideband, upper sideband, lower sideband, stereo spread or independent sideband with lower sideband on the left and upper sideband on the right, quadrature, which nulls the modulation of the strongest station on the channel and improves the audibility of weaker co-channel signals, and finally, a low distortion envelope detector. Apart from all this, there is also an audio level controller, which counteracts the objectionable surging in loudness as the carrier goes through a selective fade and the automatic gain control in the receiver unnecessarily increases the gain. The unit costs £150, and a detailed four-page information sheet is available if you send along one 14 pence British stamp or one international reply coupon to Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6-7BG.
Thank you.
Radio Facts will finish in December. We have been on the air for 3 months, and through that time you have been sending us over 100 letters each week telling us how much this kind of speech programming is appreciated. We also know that we have a fair number of very enthusiastic blind listeners. So, we remain a legal operation and close down in December, unless some government writes us out the licence we have been asking for since 3 years ago. What would the other possible options be? We could stay on the air from the Republic of Ireland, or we could come on the air from England. By making public the time and place, this would be a fairly straightforward act of civil disobedience, and the, presumably inevitable, court case would form part of the history of broadcasting. If hundreds of you write to say that is what you think we should do, then I suppose we would have to consider it seriously. But we have to make it clear now that these are not options we regard as compatible with a professional operation.
The letters you send are what has made this project worthwhile, and thank you again to everyone who's taken the trouble to write. We get letters from people aged between 17 and 70, and anyone in the media world will know that something appealing to such an age range is most unusual. Some of the historical items we have carried are development of magnetic tape, the story of radar, old BBC transmitting stations, the invention of magnetic recording from wire recorders to digital tape, and others have brought in letters from people involved in the work for up to 50 years ago. If we were staying on the air, one thing we would like to do was organise a contact point so that people who worked together years ago could get in touch with each other again.
One thing we have achieved might be the most listened to programme per watt transmitted, and we mean listened to. Many shortwave stations are heard and logged, but your letters make it clear that people do listen to Radio Facts.
The use of shortwaves has fallen significantly over the last 20 years, and everyone seems agreed that with a view to the future, what Radio Facts has demonstrated is now a useful and appropriate use of 9 kHz of the spectrum. What can you do? Well, if you think Radio Facts or something like it should be offered a licence, you could write to your Member of Parliament at the House of Commons, London SW1A OAA.
And the ministers responsible are Douglas Hurd and Timothy Renton at the Home Office, Queen Anne's Gate, London SW1H 9AT. You are the people who know it is rubbish to say that no frequencies are available. There are a greater number of you using the HF spectrum for education and recreation than all other users put together. So your voice should carry some weight in decisions about what some fraction of it is used for. To put the number of letters we get in context, it is more each week than the BBC Radio 4 Any Answers programme has been receiving recently. That's a response any station would be proud of.
And now to some letters that we have received. The first from Mr. Jari Leitinen from Finland, or a place called Vantaa in Finland, who says, "Since August, I have been tuning onto your station many times, usually at the night, when I have waited for North American AM stations. It has been fun to listen to your interesting programmes. It seems that your kind of station can tell about communications world more carefully and more detailed than any DX programme of international broadcasters. Thank you very much."
Thank you to Mr. PM Rex of Luton in England for your letter. And from Solin Tuna, "I had the great pleasure of listening to your interesting programme. Thank you, Mr. Carl Werner from Sollentuna in Sweden."
And also to Mr. Ken Moore from Brickett's Wood in St. Albans, Hertfordshire, as well as to Derek Taylor from Preston in Lancashire.
And also thank you for your letter, C.L. Pratt from Caversham Park Village near Reading. And from Penketh Warrington, Mr. R.J. Lyle says, "We listened with interest to your programmes. Thank you, Roy Lyle."
To Mr. J.R. Kane from Lille, Spain, I hope I've pronounced that correctly, in Clwyd, Wales, who says, "I've been listening to your programmes for the last 3 months and have found them most informative." That's Mr. J.R. Kane.
And now Newhaven in Sussex. The receiver is part of a hi-fi unit. Says Paul Farley, "I enjoy your programmes immensely, as I have a keen interest in electronics and broadcasting, and wish you every luck in what should be a successful venture." Thank you, Paul Farley, Newhaven in Sussex.
Two from Scotland now, first from Kevin Pickis from Edinburgh, and from Mr. Jack Kyle from Coatbridge in Scotland, who comments he was very impressed with the presenters of the programmes.
Does he mean us? "Many thanks for your programme," says Marcus Salonen from Kailamakoski in Finland.
This one's very easy to read. It's from Paul Marsh from Poole in Dorset, who says, "I think there should be more stations of this type. I've listened to your station for hours on end. I find the content very interesting." Well, thank you for that. That's from Mr. Paul Marsh from Poole in Dorset.
"Lately, I have had the pleasure of listening to your broadcasts and would like to say how much I enjoy your format of radio and electronics news," says Gordon Fisher from Blainfield, Glasgow in Scotland. A final normal programme will be on Saturday the 10th of December with a 50-year-old War of the World special on the 17th of December. Fresh programmes start on the evenings of Monday, Wednesday, Friday and Saturday.